Mancini, please. Sunday night, and that means from high above, beautiful Lake Osceola in downtown Jefferson Valley, New York, the John Mack Radio Show is on the air. Good evening. This is John McMullen, John Mack to some. Welcome you to the 179th episode of the John Mack Radio Show. The recordings for the previous 178 shows may be found at www.johnmack13.com. And John Mack is J-O-H-N-M-A-C. That's www.johnmack13.com under the radio show tab. As I've said for the last 19 weeks, my last piece for the West of the Guardian, the 212th, is still available after more than 4 months, that website www.westoftheguardian.com. And West of the Guardian is WestochesterGuardian. It was hopefully left up there to be read by every living American, that I, of course, hope that they do. It was the last of the Creative Disruption series in the paper, as after the September 29th issue, the West of the Guardian joined the ranks of the New York Herald Tribune, Washington Star, New York Journal American, and Brooklyn Eagle in the graveyard of newspapers. The issue also contains columns by ex-congressperson and vice chair of the 9/11 Commission, Lee Hamilton, and critic John Simon. In addition to the radio shows, you will also find links to my online daily newspaper at my web home. The newspaper is a curation of news articles from around the country and the world, articles relating to politics, sports, books, the environment, arts and entertainment, opinion, and technology. But the real focus, not only on opinion, but also on artificial intelligence, machine learning, big data, and what lies ahead. Try and subscribe. It's free, only one email per day, www.johnmack13.com. Now, next week, my guest will be writer, editor, and ghostwriter, Laura Balance Hilty. I hope you'll join us not only tonight, the next week, but every week at 7 p.m. Eastern Time on Sundays live. For as most to listen later. But now to this week's show, the 179th, as I mentioned. Callers may call in at any time during the show by dialing 646-716-9756. And that's 646-716-9756. But I usually hold callers until near the end of my interview with my guest. But my guest tonight is Dr. Barbara Simons, former IBM researcher and past president of the ACM, the Association for Computing, the oldest and largest international educational and scientific society for computing professionals. We'll discuss Barbara's life, as well as her views on some of the important technical issues of our time on tonight's John Mack Radio Show. Good evening, Barbara, and welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So where did you grow up?
Well, I grew up in Cincinnati, Ohio, which when I went back to visit it many years later, I decided it's a very beautiful city. When you're growing up, you have no way of telling.
Three Rivers Stadium. I know all of the rivers to come together there. Were you interested in technology as a young child?
There wasn't really, technology wasn't really talked about when I was a young child. I did find that I was good at math, and so I guess that meant I was interested in it, but, that was math.
Where'd you go to early school?
To early school?
Yeah.
Primary school? I went to first South Avondale and then North Avondale. North Avondale was built while I was, while my parents were living there, and then... that's where I went to grammar school anyway.
Do you remember your earliest aspirations then, if you weren't into technology?
Earliest what?
The earliest aspirations, yeah.
Oh, aspirations. Oh, in terms of technology.
Or anything. Did you want to be a pilot, a writer, a dancer? What did you want to
be? When I was quite young, I thought I would be a mathematician, although I didn't know what that meant. And I had this image of sitting at my kitchen table with my children peacefully playing at my feet because, of course, in those days, this was before the women's lib movement. Of course, that image was laughable for many reasons, not least of which the notion of children playing peacefully at one's feet.
And then off to high school, where'd you go?
Off to high school. Walnut Hills, which is a public college prep school in Cincinnati. It's my ideal of what a high school should be. It's actually grade 7 through 12. I think while I was still there, our principal, Harold Howe III, became President Johnson's first Secretary of Education.
Oh, and we went into science, math, or technology in high school.
Well, I was also there when I was at Walnut Hills. AP Math started. I was the second year that they had AP Math at my high school, and that was really quite helpful. I mean, that gave me a big jump initially, so that was good.
And then after high school, then what happened?
Well, then after high school, I went off to Wellesley College for a year. I didn't like it because at that point it was an all-women school, and I was interested in math. It was a bad choice. And while I was there, I met my first husband, and we decided to get married, which my parents thought was kind of absurd because I was so incredibly young. But then the following year, he was going to Berkeley as a math graduate student, and I transferred to Berkeley, and we eloped. So I was married at 18 and became a mother at 19.
Oh, okay. And did you go straight through at Berkeley, or what did you do?
Well, I went to school at Berkeley, but I never – he got his PhD and went off to, I guess it was MIT, and I, of course, tagged along and hadn't finished an undergraduate degree, and at that point I dropped out of school. So I don't have an undergraduate degree.
Okay. But you did wind up eventually get the PhD. How did you do that without
an
undergraduate degree?
Well, some years later, when we were living at Stony Brook and my former husband was chairman of the math department there, our marriage broke up, and I went back to school part-time, and I decided, in fact, about the only time, one of the few times I actually listened to one of my parents, I was having dinner with my dad, and he said, and at this point I was separated from my husband, and I had three small children, and no obvious skills. And he suggested that I should learn to program because I could probably get a job as a programmer. You know, I was good at math and all. So I actually decided to study some computer science and went back to school and studied computer science and math and just went back part-time with my kids relatively. It was, you know, I was going back to Stony Brook. It was kind of interesting because I was taking a linear algebra class at Stony Brook, and the professor who I had was someone who I had entertained in my home as chairman's wife. And he said to a mutual friend, another mathematician, that there was this girl in his class who looked a lot like Barbara Simons. He just couldn't imagine me taking a math class because he had me pegged as chairman's wife. So it was a very odd situation. But then I ended up transferring to Berkeley, where I ultimately got my PhD. So it was a very circuitous way for getting a PhD. I don't recommend it in general.
It's interesting because you're talking about I know lately you've gotten very interested in women in computing, and the when my wife was in high school in Philadelphia, she applied to Lehigh for engineering, and she got this very nice letter that she had the skills, but no one had told her that Lehigh only accepted men, and
mm-hmm.
And 35 years later, my daughter went to Lehigh. And
Well, at one point when I was married to my first husband, before I went back to school, we were living in Princeton. And I recall at that time, Princeton was all male. And while we were there, they gave tenure to the second woman on their faculty in the entire history of Princeton. So that was the first time I ever wrote a letter to a newspaper congratulating them for having made such great strides to actually have hired a second one. They published it.
Go ahead. Then they publish it?
They did publish it, yeah. Well, this was the local newspaper that published it. Yeah.
And then years later, when she went to Penn State or right after that, and then she wanted to do engineering, she was dissuaded from it because women aren't engineers, so she did math.
Right.
So I still don't understand how you're able to continue to the PhD without having the undergraduate degree.
Well, so I went back to school at Stony Brook, and I started taking undergraduate courses, obviously, because I was still an undergraduate. And in those days, this was like in the mid-70s. No, this was in the early 70s. Computer science was a very young field. It didn't have a lot of depth. And, for example, in those days, compilers were a graduate course, believe it or not, which, of course, it wouldn't be today. I believe also operating systems were graduate courses, if I'm not mistaken. So I took the undergraduate courses, but very quickly I was starting to do graduate work. And my professors, I was a much more serious student when I went back than I had been initially, because I was choosing to go back. I suspect a lot of older students have that experience. And so I did very well when I went back, better than I had when I was an undergraduate initially. And so I was able to transfer to Berkeley, and I applied to graduate school at Berkeley, and I was admitted because I was doing graduate work at Stony Brook, and I had some good recommendations from my faculty there. So that's how I did it. I did have an interesting experience, however, because when I had finished my dissertation and was about to get my PhD at Berkeley, I had to go to Sproul Hall and pick up the cover sheet for my dissertation. And one of the things that they had on my application was that I had a master's degree from Stony Brook, which I didn't. I was working on a master's degree when I was there, but I never got it. And so I foolishly said to the person who gave me this sheet, "I don't have a master's degree." So she said, "Well, we'll get back to you." But meanwhile, they discovered that I had not met the admissions requirements for Berkeley. So they were not going to give me my degree, my PhD, which I had already done all the work on. So, you know, but I hadn't met the admissions requirements. And that meant that, so I had this sort of frantic call meeting with my advisor, and my thesis advisor discovered that there was this obscure rule at Berkeley where I could get a master's degree by passing a test. So we had a virtual test, which never was really taken, and so when I got my PhD, I got a master's at the same time. I wanted to give back the master's because I hadn't earned it, but my mother totally freaked out when I suggested that because she was afraid I would lose the PhD, and I hadn't gotten anything since high school, and she was just tired of waiting around for me to get some damn degree.
Your PhD dissertation involves scheduling theory, and your bio mentioned that it solved an open problem in it. Without greatly confusing the audience, could you give us an overview of that?
Yeah, it's actually a fairly easy problem to state. It has to do with machines and scheduling jobs in machines, but another way to think of it for someone who may not be a computer scientist is think of having airplanes and having landing fields that you want to land the airplanes on. Well, let's take initially you've got one landing field, and you are given a list of planes that are going to be coming in that day. And for each plane, you are given the time when that plane will arrive in the airspace over the field and the time, which presumably is quite a bit later, when it will run out of fuel and crash. And the very simplifying assumption is that it takes one unit of time to land each plane. So it can be landed as soon as it is in the airspace in one unit of time or whenever you decide to land it. And so the question is, if you're given a set of planes with these release times and deadlines, the deadline being when the plane will crash, can you schedule them all so that you don't have two planes landing at the same time, and every plane lands at least by the time it arrives and not before it would crash. So that's a very simplified version of the problem. The general version is you've got multiple planes, multiple landing fields, and they can arrive at any rational time, and they take one unit of time to land, if that makes sense to people.
Now, at the time you did the PhD, though, planes have been landing at JFK and at a
right.
and whatever
right.
for a long time. How do they do it before you came up with this?
Well, they don't use my algorithm. I basically came up with a fast algorithm for doing this, but this is a very simplified version because obviously it doesn't take one unit of time to land. Each plane doesn't take the same amount of time to land, although they might be close. And I mean, I guess that there's a generalized the very general version of this problem is probably computationally difficult, but there are simplifying versions where if they take differing amounts of time to land, that can make it complicated. So it was a simplified version, but it was an open problem, and it really wasn't airplanes that we were talking about. It was scheduling jobs and computers that we're talking about.
Okay, I got it. From an operating system standpoint.
Yeah, that sort of thing. Sort of like the back end of an operating system.
Now you're in my ballpark. Then what happened after you had the PhD?
Well, I got a job at IBM Research in San Jose in the theory group, and I was doing work in theory and algorithms professionally. And I also got involved with ACM, the Association for Computing Machinery, which, as you said, is the oldest and largest Educational and Scientific Society of Computer Professionals. So I was doing some stuff there. And then at one point, I was asked by the president of ACM to chair the Scientific Freedom and Human Rights Committee, which turned out to be an interesting thing to do because the committee had been formed to give voice to Russian refuseniks. So that was what was going on then, was refuseniks. But that was mainly what it was focused on, and it wasn't looking at other areas of human rights that could affect computing professionals. So I was able, for example, to expand it to look at South Africa, situation in South Africa and other parts of the world where there were human rights violations.
Now, you mentioned South Africa. That's interesting. At that time, IBM was being pushed hard to get out of South Africa. Did any of your IBM IBM corporate presence come into conflict or anything you were doing with ACM?
Not with that, no. I did have problems with IBM later on with some of what I was doing, but not with the Scientific Freedom and Human Rights Group. I mean, we weren't, this was not, ACM wasn't getting involved with any kind of embargo or anything like that. We were basically trying to publicize situations for individuals who were being persecuted or having their human rights impacted.
I was an ACM member back in probably 1966, and then went on for a good while.
Boy, that's
and then
before me.
Then I wound up being more active in it in the early 80s.
Mm-hmm.
When I joined, the ACM meant the Association for Computing Machinery, then now it's the Association for Computing. When did it make the change?
Okay.
And why?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I know they fussed around with the logos and so on, but ACM still stands for Association for Computing Machinery. That is what it stands for. I think the logo is Association for Computing because ACM is sort of an archaic name. As you know, it was started back in the days when there weren't many computers, and so there was so being an Association for Computing Machinery kind of made sense back then, maybe. But for a long time, people have been struggling with the name because the name really doesn't match what the organization has become.
You found the ACM's U.S. Public Policy Committee, USACM, 1993. Is that the group that funds the annual Computer Freedom and Privacy Conference?
Well, for a while, yes. USACM was the main group for CFP when ACM took it over. But I'm not sure that ACM is still involved with this, with the Computer Freedom and Privacy Conference anymore. I honestly don't know, but I think possibly not.
No, I probably wasn't active with it after about the 10th year. I chaired the scholarship committee for 3 years, and for 4 years, I guess. And then I did something else. Probably the last one I was active at was in Chicago when it was held there, the conference. How long were you active with the group?
With USACM or CFP?
No, the CFP.
Oh, with CFP. I don't know. I've been active off and on. I mean, I've gone to several CFP conferences, and I was on program committee 1 year. So I guess at that level, I've been active. I haven't gone recently.
And was your IBM career always in research, or did you do something else with IBM?
Well, I did at one point move into another division of IBM where I was doing slightly more applied work, doing compiler optimization. But it was the fact that I was doing compiler optimization was built on the fact that my theoretical work had been in scheduling, which, as I say, was related to the back end of compilers.
You served as ACM president from 1998 to 2000. Please tell us about the issues you had to face during your term as president.
Licensing of software engineers was a big issue, surprisingly. It's something I hadn't thought about at all before I became president. And then I was sort of confronted with this by somebody who was presenting it to me as if it was a fait accompli. But I didn't really know anything about it. And so I appointed a Blue Ribbon Commission to look into the question. Some of the people one person in particular I remember who was on the commission started off being very enthusiastic about it because she was working on fault tolerant issues and felt that licensing would be a way of getting more reliable software. By the end of the study, after that initial commission finished, she was ambivalent, and then I created a couple of more to look at specific aspects of licensing software or potential software engineering licensing, and she co-chaired one of those committees. This is Nancy Levison at MIT, and by the end of that, she was firmly against licensing. And the reason is that it's really a legal issue, and it's modeled after civil engineering. A lot of the things that one has to learn or tests that one has to pass to become a licensed engineer, I mean, this is written into law, and most of it has nothing to do with computing per se. And there are a whole host of other reasons why the people from ACM who studied this issue came out against licensing of software engineers, and so did I. When we started off, I had no opinion whatsoever. I hadn't thought about it. But it's very interesting, and these reports are still buried somewhere in the ACM archives. They were looking at body of knowledge, and that was one study, and the other one was safety critical issues, which was the one that Nancy co-chaired. And basically, the feeling was we were not ready to license software engineers at this time, and it was pretty negative.
You became an early expert in electronic voting and have served on a commission convened by President Clinton, leading to a 2001 report, and your latest served under the Obama administration. You're also the co-author of a report that led to the cancellation of the Department of Defense project. A long time ago, I used to exchange email with another person who was into electronic voting. She was the University of Pennsylvania professor who wrote extensively. I forget her name. Do you have any idea who I'm talking about?
You're not thinking of Rebecca Mercury, are you?
Yes,
she's
I am.
She's actually not a professor, University of Pennsylvania professor, but yes, she was involved early.
I thought she was at Penn.
No, I don't believe so.
Vote manipulation has been for a long time the subject of both fact and rumor. I remember there were rumors that JFK swung the 1960 election through fraud in Illinois. William F. Buckley maintained that his dead grandfather had voted for Lyndon Johnson, and the president on the TV drama scandal was elected through the to vote tampering. Now we have the rumor that the Russians not only influenced the past election, but hacked into our systems. How much credibility do you give to the rumors of election hacking?
Well, we know that at least two, and I think four, voter registration databases were hacked, and well over 20 others were probed, poked around, and conceivably could have been penetrated. One of the disturbing things about the hacking of the voter registration databases is that a hacker could have gone in and changed information about legitimate voters so that when they went to the polls, either the names were not there or there was something that was wrong about their registration, so they would have to vote provisionally. A hacker could also have padded the voting rolls by adding names and then having those fake voters vote remotely by paper ballots, so they wouldn't have to show up at the polls. So far as I know, there has been no analysis done as to whether either of these things may have happened in this past election. I really would love to get figures about how many voters had to vote provisionally, because that's what happens if you go to the polls and there's some problem with your voter registration. You will usually be given a provisional ballot, but then that ballot may or may not be counted. And in a number of places, provisional ballots frequently aren't counted, but it can depend on the location. But in any case, I would like to know how many people had to vote provisionally, especially in some of the key areas. I don't have that information. I don't know if anybody does, and I doubt that anybody has actually tried to examine some of these voter registration databases to see if there are a number of fake names in them. We also don't know if the actual voting machines or the vote tabulating machines were hacked, because nobody is really checking them. I don't know if the Russians stopped at the gate and only hacked emails of the DNC and other places, and the RNC too, by the way, or if they actually went in and hacked some of our voting technology in addition to the voter registration databases. But I am very concerned that in 2020 and almost certainly in 2018 as well, our systems will be hacked if we don't fix them, if we don't make them secure, and if we don't check them. We need to have paper ballots everywhere. Right now, 30% of the country votes on paperless machines, which can't even be checked. In Pennsylvania, for example, which is an important swing state, 80% of the people vote on paperless machines. My takeaway from the recounts, which were aborted prematurely, obviously, is that we are sending a message to the world that says, hack us, because we have insecure voting technology and we do not want to look. So what we have to do, and I've pledged myself to do everything I can to make this happen, is we have to get paper ballots everywhere as quickly as possible, well before 2020. And we need to get laws in place that require post-election manual ballot audits to check on the computers that are tabulating our votes, because anyone who's worked with computers knows that computers can have software bugs and even hidden malicious malware that could rig an election. We've introduced computers into our voting in this country, but we haven't changed the laws. And we're now paying the price for that. I really, really fear for our democracy if we don't get our act together.
And in 2008, you had co-authored a report of the book, Broken Ballots, where would your vote count? Now, has any of this...
2012, but yeah.
Oh, okay. It said 2008 here. Has any of the the recommendations that you might have been made in the book or in the July 2015 thing that you did with the U.S. Vote Foundation, have any of them been implemented, or are the recommendations there that would tighten this up at all?
Well, there's been slow progress. So the movement in the country has been towards paper ballots, away from paperless machines, but not enough. And it's no longer acceptable to have slow improvement. We really can't tolerate that anymore because the risk is so great. Another great concern is internet voting. There's been a lot of push for internet voting. Ironically, among Democrats, I think more than Republicans, because I think they all feel that internet voting will increase voter participation, whereas we know from internet voting that's occurred in Canada and other places that internet voting will have little to no increase, will show little to no increase in voter participation, and in fact, contrary to what one might think intuitively, internet voting does not increase voting by younger people. It just basically, the people who vote over the internet reflect the same age ranges that occur in standard voting. So we've been, when I say we, I should clarify that I'm board chair of Verified Voting, which is the only national organization working to make our voting secure. It's basically a bunch of geeks and some attorneys. And we've been successful at preventing internet voting from becoming widespread, but it's an ongoing struggle. So that's another area where we need to make sure, we need to basically stop it. Because 32 states allow some people to vote over the internet, typically military and overseas voters, and Alaska lets anyone vote over the internet. And these are proprietary systems. They do not allow independent security experts to attempt to break into them to check how secure or insecure they are. And it's basically, with all the hacking that we've seen, it's very, very dangerous for anyone to be voting over the internet.
You were able to stop one thing through a report that you participated in, the Department of Defense Internet Voting Project. How were you able to do that? And how did the Department of Defense happen to get into it anyhow? Because of the military overseas? Was that the
impetus? Yes. It was going to be for military voters. And initially it was going to be for military voters from any state, but that got narrowed down. Basically what happened was that some people, there was money made available to examine the system, and fortuitously some of the people who had this money brought in some computer scientists to look at it. And I have to say, when I was first invited to participate, this is for the CERV project, when I was first invited to participate, I thought that internet voting was probably an okay idea. I mean, not well, at that point I guess I'd already been on the Clinton study, but I wasn't super opposed. But the more I studied it, the more opposed I became. And basically the entire computer security community in the United States is opposed to internet voting the way it is today, for sure. I mean, there's some talk about possibly being able to do it safely using encryption or some other technologies, but all of the systems that are currently being deployed, all of the commercial systems, do not use adequate crypto or anything that would make us believe that they're secure.
It's interesting to hear computer professionals speak out against what appears to be computer innovation, but I think more and more people are beginning to realize, not only with voting, but with the non-secure banking systems we have,
right,
credit card systems that we,
right,
that we push ahead without properly securing these things, which exposes not only our democratic process, but all of us, you know. So it's
well, it's kind of interesting, because when we first started, a bunch of computer scientists started working on what got us involved with the whole voting thing was this national move towards paperless voting machines. And one of the ironies is that at various times we've been called Luddites, for example. And the people calling us Luddites are people who typically don't use computers very much, right? It's the computer people who are saying, don't do it, don't do it, and then we're being called Luddites as if we don't like computers. I mean, you know, I spend all my day on the computer. I don't know what I would do without it. But there are proper ways to use computers and not proper ways to use computers. And unfortunately, with voting, computers were brought in a way which was really not well thought through. And not only are these systems now ancient, but they were badly designed. These whole touchscreen machine computer, you know, voting systems were dreadfully engineered. They were just slapped together quickly because there was all of a sudden $4 billion in government money made available to modernize as a result of Florida 2000 and 2002. So these things were rushed to market before there were any decent standards, before computer scientists really got into looking at what they should be like. and before people had really thought through the problem. So we now are stuck with voting in much of the country on totally inadequate, totally insecure machines that should be recycled for parts, not even sold to anybody else, unless it's a museum, maybe.
You also work with the League of Women Voters on election auditing. Tell us about that. Does that tie into this also?
Well, the League of Women Voters report was a one on general auditing, and it covered all kinds of auditing. So, for example, one of the things that should be done in every election kind of auditing is where you it's called reconciliation, where you want to make sure that the number of votes that you've recorded equals the number of people who signed in, or if not, that you know what happened, that maybe somebody started to vote and didn't finish. But you need to reconcile all these things. That seems like a no-brainer, but it isn't necessarily done very well at times, sometimes not at all. So the auditing covered that report covered the gamut. What I've been focusing on for the past several years is something called risk-limiting audits, which is also, by the way, I believe mentioned in that report. The idea there is that you use statistics to basically to minimize the number of ballots you have to look at in order to get a certain level of confidence that the declared winners are the correct winners. Either that, or if the declared winners are not the correct winners, you end up with a total manual recount. And the idea, again, is that we need to check on the computers because we can't trust them. And if there's one message that I think computer scientists have been trying to give in this whole debate, it's that you cannot trust the computers. You simply must check on them. You can't take their word, especially in something so critical as elections, where there's a lot of money at stake. And, you know, it would be very cheap to bribe some very clever computer programmer to hack machines, or even to get a job with one of the vendors and insert malware at that level, because these machines are not adequately tested.
I remember years ago, and I forget which election it was, but there was almost a conspiracy theory that the Diebold Corporation was involved in election manipulation for Republicans. Do you remember that? Rumored?
Yes, well, this was because of a letter written by the head of the Diebold Voting Company, which is a subset of all of Diebold, saying that he wanted to make sure that he would do everything he could to make sure that the president was reelected. This was under George Bush's, I think, W's term. And this was sent to Republican donors, and it created a storm of protest because people said, how can you possibly say that when you're manufacturing the very machines, producing the very machines that are being used to count our votes? This is an outrage. Now, whether or not they did, I have no idea. I mean, I sort of think that if he was planning to rig the election, he wouldn't have been so obvious about it. But then again, it's possible he didn't expect anybody to pick up on it. So I just have no idea. But I would say that there is a very questionable election that occurred on Diebold machines back in 2002, I believe it was, when Max Cleland, who was running for Senate and also the governor in Georgia and the Democratic candidate for governor, both lost, although they were heading the polls before the election. That race was run on paperless Diebold voting machines, and we know that there were last-minute changes being made to the machines just before the election, and nobody has been able to see the software, and, of course, now it's long gone. So, you know, it's quite possible that election was hacked. Nobody knows, and that's a very unhealthy situation, because if we're going to have a vibrant democracy, a democracy where people really feel a part of it, we have to be able to prove to the losers and the losers' supporters that they truly lost, and that means you can't have secret software which is deciding the election with no checks. You just can't do that.
Wasn't the Max Cleland also the person that was mocked for his disabilities?
Yes, well, he had lost three limbs in Vietnam.
Right.
I think that one of the ads did mock him. Yeah, that was an ugly election. But the mocking doesn't mean that the election was stolen. And in fact, I'm not saying that it was. What I'm saying is that nobody knows, and that's not good. That's not healthy.
So I understand that. I'm just recalling that we had people who were willing to mock a war hero. That just came out when last year when Trump really was extremely nasty about John McCain and him not supporting people who were losers, who were captured. He liked the winners, and I just thought all of that shows such insensitivity to what these people gave in the service of their country. I just think that was
horrible. Yeah, I agree.
Who is the U.S. Boat Foundation? You also did some work with them.
Well, I mean, I'm not directly involved with them, but if you're talking about E2EIVI, I keep on calling it. I'm trying to remember what it said. We did a report looking
right.
at end-to-end internet verifiable voting, basically. Those initials are in there somewhere. And that the report came out with a series of suggestions. Basically, what it said was that we're not there yet. Any vendor who claims that they're using end-to-end are not, or at least they're not using it properly. And there are a number of conditions that will have to be met if this is ever going to be a feasible, secure form of voting. So these are necessary conditions, but they haven't yet been met, and we don't know whether or not they will be met.
Do you feel there's enough public and interest and the legislative interest in ever getting this to work to your satisfaction and to other computer professional satisfaction?
Well, since the 2016 election, there's been a lot more interest in the work we've been doing, which is sort of a mixed blessing, because I wish that the reasons for the interest weren't there. The fact that we know that there was hacking by an unfriendly country, but there is more interest now. Whether or not we're going to succeed in what needs to be done to make our elections secure, I don't know. I hope so. I'm going to work my damnedest to make it happen. And verified voting is on the front lines trying to do this, but we're a very small organization. We don't have a lot of resources. We need to get a great deal more resources, because it's going to be a huge battle, and we're going to be up against some pretty significant opposition.
You mentioned George W. Bush before. What was your position, if any, on the hanging Chad nonsense in Florida? That was obviously a design problem rather an input document design problem rather than a computer problem. What did you think of that?
A couple of thoughts. It was a design problem. I agree. That was a badly designed system, in part because once you voted on the system, if you held up the IBM card, you couldn't tell how you'd voted. You could see the holes in the card, but you couldn't tell how you voted. Now, we know about the hanging chads. That was a maintenance issue, I think, in large part. I voted on such a machine in Palo Alto, California, and we didn't have a problem. But I think in African-American areas of some of the states where these problems did occur, the chad trays weren't emptied. And if the chad trays isn't empty, then when you push down, it may not go all the way through, and hence you get things like pregnant chads, hanging chads, and so on. So while I think it with proper maintenance, the hanging chad issue, I think, wouldn't have occurred. The fact is it was still a lousy, poorly engineered, poorly designed system. Unfortunately, what a lot of people took away from that experience, from that whole situation, was that paper is bad. And that fueled the move to paperless, computerized voting machines. That was, of course, not the lesson they should have taken away. The lesson they should have taken away is the one that you said, which was basically that it was a badly designed system. It wasn't the paper, it was the design.
We also had the problem, and whether it was for voters non-paying attention or stupidity, people voting for Pat Buchanan when they wanted to vote for Al Gore. So obviously there was something wrong there in the design. If you can't tell who you're voting for.
Yeah, well, I mean, I wouldn't quite say it's stupidity. That seems a bit unfair. It was very bad human factors. And if you look at the ballot where that occurred, it's actually very confusing. It was a badly designed ballot. It wasn't properly tested. Again, so human factors is another area where things have to be done properly, because I mean, it really was a very confusing ballad. I think there's a picture of it in our book, if I'm not mistaken. I'm pretty sure there is. Badly designed. Bad
images. Okay, I'll back off on stupidity. I believe that you were an early member of the Electronic Frontier Foundation. I was present at the press conference that denounced the group. I do know that you were honored by EFF as the pioneer. Describe what that honor meant to you.
Well, it meant a great deal, and it was very frustrating because I don't remember where the EFF conference was, but I was in a different location, and I was scheduled to go there to receive the award, which I was very excited about, but there was a terrible storm, and my flight was canceled, so I couldn't get there. So I never actually had the pleasure of receiving the award, but I'm on the EFF Board of Advisors now.
You also have received, obviously, many awards from many people. The Norbert Wiener Award from the Computer Professional for Social Responsibility, CNET picks you as one of the 26 Internet visionaries, by Open Computing as one of the top 100 women in computing, Science Magazine featuring you. Berkeley has given you the Alumnus of the Year Award from the Science Department. Computer the Research has given you the Distinguished Service Award. You're the only woman who have received the Distinguished Engineering Alumni Award from the College of Engineering that you see Berkeley. Where do you keep all these things? Do you have a storeroom for them?
Well, this is sort of embarrassing. No. I mean, most of them are just, you know, you go to a ceremony and somebody says nice things about you.
Well, that's nice, anyhow.
Yeah.
In addition to voting, there are many other issues of concern to both the technology industry and the general public. Let's look at a few. I know they've been very active in attempts to bring more women into the technical areas. In fact, not only women, but also minorities. Would you tell us both of your activities and the state of the industry now?
When I was a graduate student at Berkeley, as you undoubtedly realize, when I went back to school, I was quite a bit older than my fellow students. And there was another woman there who was also older. We were both also single moms. And we were both also more politically aware, I guess I would say, than our younger colleagues. And so we just got involved with a number of things on campus. We started an informal women's group there, just a bunch of us getting together for lunch once a week in the commons room to sort of provide support because there were so few of us in the graduate school there in computer science. And actually... one of the things we did was we learned that there was some money available for student organizations, so we decided to make ourselves an official organization, which meant that we went down to Sproul Hall again, and the first person to register was declared herself the president, the second was the vice president, and so on. So that's how I became the first vice president of the organization. And then we decided to put on a conference, and we asked for, I think, $500 and got 50, something ridiculous. So then we went to the department and asked for money, and we ended up raised with $6,000 between the College of Engineering and donors, and we put on a conference. And one of the things that happened at the conference was one of the deans who was speaking to, it was mainly women, there was some minority, it was mainly a women's conference, and he said, look, don't try, and a lot of them came from letters and science. He said, don't try to get into engineering, you'll never get in. He basically said that. And it turned out that Elizabeth Scott, who at the time was the department chair of his chair of the stat department, was at that meeting, and she was furious, and she wrote an angry letter, and the guy was kicked out of his deanship. So that was an interesting experience. But then subsequently, as my friend Paula Hawthorne, the other older woman with single mom, and I were about to graduate, she was a year ahead of me, we decided that we needed to get something on campus. And so we worked actually with the faculty, and we were able to put together a reentry program for women and minorities in computer science. And our goal was to reach out to older students, basically, who hadn't thought of going into computer science when they were younger because they were discouraged from doing so, but who had the ability to become computer scientists. And what we did was we let they were basically allowed to take classes, regular classes in the computer science department. That was it. They weren't given any special degrees or anything, and it was up to them to do well in the classes and get to the point where they could get into graduate school, because that was our goal, for them to all go to graduate school, and they could get recommendations from faculty members who were teaching real classes where they were competing with everybody else, as opposed to having special classes. And we felt very strongly that we didn't want special privileges for women, because if a weak woman were to be admitted to graduate school, she would probably fail, and it wouldn't be good for her, and it wouldn't be good for the whole image of women's ability to participate in the field. So we wanted to make sure that anyone who did get into graduate school was qualified, and this was our way of doing it, was just to provide them with the opportunity to obtain the necessary knowledge to get into graduate school on their own. But the program was killed. Sorry.
So go ahead.
The program was killed. It was, I don't remember, Prop 187 or 209 under Pete Wilson. One of those propositions was anti-affirmative action, and the other was an anti-immigrant proposition. And the anti-affirmative action proposition was used to kill the reentry program, which is too bad because the faculty loved it. They had older students who were really serious about being in school, as had been my experience. And there was only a small number. There was never very many. But they really, really loved the reentry students. And the first PhD was actually a Hispanic man who got his PhD at UC Davis.
And nobody tried to bring it back under Jerry Brown?
I don't believe it's come back, no.
I don't
know if the propositions are still in effect. You know, these are propositions that were passed by the state. I mean, I think that the issues still hold.
There have been a real focus on getting interest in technology to young girls, where it's pointed out that young boys play the shoot 'em up games and the girls tend not to be interested in that, and then that carries forward. Have you been involved in any of the programs or the ideas to get girls interested in technology at a young age?
Well, I used to be involved. I haven't been so much anymore. I know that people have done studies of, like, the games, especially, like, in the 80s, where, as you say, the games will kind of shoot 'em up, or, you know, you go into the video store where, you know, the computer games, and, you know, they have these pictures of these really buxom women in bikinis on the cover, which I can understand the appeal to teenage boys, but it doesn't really do a whole lot for the girls.
Right.
And basically they were saying this is a boy thing. So I do think it had, it's sort of interesting because in the very early days of computing, there were a lot of women involved, a lot. Fran Allen, who was the first woman to receive the Turing Award from ACM, which is like the Nobel Prize of Computing, said when she was first working at IBM, which was many years ago, computing was like a nothing. It didn't have the cachet that it has now, and there were lots of women doing it. And as it became more more of a hot area, women seemed to be getting pushed out. I don't think anybody did it intentionally, but or very few people did, but that's what happened. I mean, and then there were little things that could have an impact. Like at Berkeley, there were originally two computer science departments. This is actually a good thing, not a bad thing. There were two computer science departments. There are at Berkeley. One is in the College of Letters and Science, and one is in the College of Engineering. So a lot of the women who did computer science at Berkeley did it through Letters and Science, because a lot of girls don't think of going into engineering. At other schools, at many other schools, it's always in the College of Engineering, and that's going to reduce the number of women, because women are less likely to go into engineering.
Okay.
Not intentionally. I don't think it's an intentional thing, but just, you know, what happens.
Another concern is privacy in the age of big data and the amalgamation of data captured about us by both the government and such firms as Axion, and the possible misuse of such data. I know that you're on the board of Epic, the electronic privacy information center. What can we or should we be able to do to protect ourselves in this area?
Boy, yeah, that's a real hard one. I have to say, it's getting to the point where it's difficult to communicate with people and feel that it's secure. I certainly don't, of course, I've never put anything in, well, tried not to put anything in email. I've sometimes slipped, but I've tried not to put anything in email that I wouldn't want to be publicized because email is so untrustworthy. But it makes it difficult, for example, if you're trying to deter, you know, come up with some political strategy or something or other, how do you communicate with people? How do you make sure that, or even like a business plan, I could see, how do you make sure that you're, you know, the people you might be negotiating against aren't reading your email, aren't checking your stuff? I mean, this isn't just a political. It covers all areas of life. And I think it's a really, really difficult problem. It would be nice, for example, if our cell phones had built-in encryption so that nobody would be able to listen into them, but they tend not to so much, or at least not as much as they should. It would be nice if we had email that had built-in encryption. And, of course, this was all opposed by law enforcement who wanted to be able to monitor people's communications. And that has, you know, I can understand why they would want to do that, but it also has a negative a side effect of creating problems in other areas.
I remember the last year, I believe it was, that the University of Pittsburgh owned 6 hospitals in Western Pennsylvania area, and the hospitals have their own insurance company, and the insurance company was pushing predictive analysis, and one of the things that it would do, it would ask people to be insured about their personal habits, and do you smoke, do you drink, do you do this, do you exercise, and but they didn't tell the people that they're also buying information from Axion on them. So if you had said that you didn't drink, but your credit card showed that you were spending $500 a month at the liquor store, they would downsize you, or they wouldn't insure you. Now, it might be that you have an alcoholic father-in-law who you're feeding his habit for a month, and because of his image, you didn't drink, but could never have the chance to explain that. Now, I think that's totally unethical, but there weren't many flags raised about it when it came out. Are you familiar with that incident?
I'm not familiar with that incident, but I certainly agree with you that as you described it, it sounds quite unethical.
And how do you handle that with that legislation that these companies, and I know Bob O'Hara from the Washington Post had the book about 8 years ago about No Place to Hide, about the amalgamators, and people really don't seem to understand that every time they go through an easy pass or anything they buy with a credit card or anything they buy through an awards program or all these other things, it's recorded, and it doesn't stay with the credit card companies or the easy pass. It's all brought together by the amalgamation companies, and that can impact your ability to get into graduate school, or to be hired, or to do whatever. And there doesn't seem to be the regulation there that I'm aware of, anyhow, that leans on them. Have you looked at that too, from Epic? Or
I certainly think there should be more regulations. I quite agree with you. I think one of the problems is that, and this is something we've heard a lot, people will say, why should I be concerned about privacy? I have nothing to hide. And you may think you have nothing to hide at some point or other, but everybody, I think, has something to hide. And even if they don't, under a hostile political regime, you might find all of a sudden that you have a lot to hide, things that you would consider perfectly reasonable to do, but that they don't.
Yeah. Finally, one of the big concerns that I feel not enough attention is being paid to by politicians or policymakers is the ongoing loss of jobs at every level to the spread of every type of automation, robotics, intelligent algorithms, machine learning, et cetera. Some economists are advocating a guaranteed annual wage, while some big names in science and technology, such as Stephen Hawking, Bill Gates, Elon Musk, are issuing dire warnings about the future of humankind. All while Congress is in its eighth year of the fighting about Obamacare. What's your prediction about the ongoing impact of automation that might and what might or will be done in this area, do you think?
Well, this certainly is not an area of expertise of mine. But one thing that seems pretty obvious is that education becomes increasingly important in a situation like this because unskilled jobs are going away. And I would like to see us significantly increase what we spend on education, and especially, of course, for people who are economically underprivileged, because their schools tend to be the worst, and they stay in this cycle of poverty and hopelessness because they don't get educations. So, in fact, I think, as an Israeli friend observed to me, the idea of local public schools is a way that Americans have of keeping blacks down. That's what he said. And I think there's some truth to that. By requiring local people to fund the education means that people living in poor neighborhoods have less funding available for their education. That seems very unfair to me.
I remember I have children in a public school, the grammar school, in Riverdale section of the Bronx. And it was in addition to it being a primarily Jewish neighborhood, it was also had the very high percentage of Japanese, because the Japanese families that were here 3 to 5 years to work for some of the companies tended to rent in Riverdale. And because of that, number one, there was no busing, even though the minority, the Japanese minority was by and large more affluent than the majority. But when there was extreme budget cuts in New York City, and they cut the funding for the school, so they would have had to give up an extra librarian, and at that time, two VCRs and some after-school programs, the parent association says, well, we'll pay for it. And I thought that was terrific for my neighborhood. But people in Harlem were not able to have the parent association kicking thousands of dollars for these programs. So there was, while it benefited me, it was terribly unfair to poor neighborhoods, and it was, you know, and that struck me then, and it keeps going on, obviously, throughout the country. The other thing that's extremely important is to be able to adapt. People, since jobs go away so rapidly, that you have to constantly be good at what you do to hold a job. You also have to be looking over your shoulder to what's coming down the pike. And I remember when I was doing one graduate program, like you, years later, after I already had been busy for 25 years, I was on a team at Marist College with a bunch of folks to work for IBM. And one of them was involved in an APL program. I said, you know, you really should get into C because everyone's doing that. And he said, when IBM wants me to get into C, they'll train me and everything will be all right. So I kept saying, I'm not sure, you know. And then a year later, we're going to C, and well, I can learn that. No, we already have these people coming in that already know it, but we'll try to find you a job elsewhere in the company. People didn't realize that there was another group when they had the first buyouts from IBM. I was the program chair of the HCM subgroup in Westchester County, and the whole lot of IBM people on it, and a bunch of them took the buyouts. And I ran into one fellow. How's it going? Oh, it's going pretty good. What are you doing? I'm consulting. Oh, then how's that going? Well, not too good because people aren't calling. He never had any experience that you have to be out. That it's not like what he was doing in IBM where he was told his next assignment and what he had to do next week. And it was, you know, it just seems that we didn't learn then, and I'm not sure that we're learning now. And the only people that I see really wound up about this are these two computer two professors from MIT who have written books about it, Robert Reich, who talks about it. But I don't see anyone in Congress that seems overly concerned about this.
Yeah, well, I mean, I agree. And the idea that, for example, we're going to bring back a lot of jobs in coal is just ridiculous because those jobs are gone for good. Likewise, a lot of the manufacturing jobs. But as I said, I think this is not my area of expertise, but it just seems obvious to me that we should be spending a lot of money on education. I have to say also that I am very concerned by these not simply anti-intellectual attitude that we find among some of our policymakers, but also the anti-science, anti-engineering attitude. And getting back to the whole voting thing, it reminds me a little bit of the climate change debate, where, again, with climate change, the scientists are being denigrated, accused of various things that, just saying what they want to say to get money or whatever. Likewise, the computer scientists were denigrated when we were out there saying paperless voting machines are a really bad idea. You know, we'd be told, you may know about computers, but we know about elections. And pretty little head, we'll take care of it all. Whereas, in fact, they didn't know what they were doing at all because they didn't know about computers. So it's disconcerting when one encounters this sort of know-nothing attitude.
And they don't understand that computers, they're now writing sports stories. They're now about gathering game statistics, the newspapers. They're now doing middle management and upper management jobs. This just doesn't dawn on them because you don't know about sports. What do you know about running some company, you know? And I don't know. It's pretty scary. What's next for you?
What's next for me? Well, the next 4 years I'm going to be fighting to try to make our voting system secure. If we're successful at that, I'll consider it a huge achievement because it's going to be really hard. Like I said, that's what I'm going to be doing. That's it.
We've covered a lot of ground tonight. What else would you like the audience to know about Barbara Simons?
Well, if they're interested in how insecure our voting system is, I urge them to go to Verified Voting's website. Just type in Verified Voting. It's one word. And you can go to the website and learn more about the kinds of machines that are used where you live in your state, learn about the kinds of audits that are done, if any, and learn about the machines themselves. And hopefully support us because like I say, it's going to be a huge fight.
Send me the URL. When I write the story about this, I'll include ending with the link.
Thank you. Thank you. That's great. Thank you. Thank you.
Anything else you want to tell us?
Anything else?
Children?
It's a beautiful day here today. Go ahead.
Did your children follow you into technology?
No. I actually lost a son, my two children. My other son is very involved with fighting climate change, and my daughter is very concerned about early childhood education. So they're both doing really, really great stuff, but they're not technologists. But I'm very proud of them.
Neither are my two children, and I'm very proud of them too. One's in San Rafael, used to be in Hollywood. He's a screenwriter, TV writer.
Oh, cool. Well, that sounds like fun.
Well, thank you, Barbara. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it too.
A bit of commercial information. My books are available at Amazon. I blog at medium.com and published the Daily Letter I mentioned earlier. Send any comments or questions to me at johnmack13@gmail.com. And in the words, the Mets radio announcer Howie Rose, after the Mets win, put it in a book. I hope you'll join us next week, then every week. And Henry Mancini, who brought us on, will take us off.